moment in the day would also be in our databases, and then we could use that to figure out if we're interested in someone or the people that person's been in contact with, you know, where were they physically? And they actually got some data, and they started testing the system, and then shut it down. That was before Snowden, but it sort of shows you the, you know, the surveillance state, or the, you know, the people who play with toys at the NSA see the technological operational capabilities of something as interesting, and they play with it. And sometimes the technology gets way beyond what policymakers have decided is actually a good idea, or what, and is certainly way beyond what the rules were written to regulate.
And the prosecution of whistleblowers. I mean, you know it very well intimately at the New York Times, your colleague James Risen, who is gone after as a journalist by the Obama administration, intensified after Bush. He thought with Obama these charges would be dropped. Instead, it went the other way, although ultimately it was resolved.
Of his alleged source.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And also the questioning of him demanding that he release information
that
he testified, and face
right.
jail.
Mm-hmm.
What about the whistleblowers? You write about them in this book.
That's right. So I have, you know, in some ways, Obama sort of continued at least the outlines maybe of what he inherited from Bush. In some ways, like torture, he ratcheted it back. In a few ways, he goes beyond Bush. He uses drones and does targeted killings in a much more intense clip. And another way in which things are different in a more aggressive way under Obama is that this administration is overseeing now the criminal prosecution of 9 leakers. I would, as a side issue, I would quarrel with calling them all whistleblowers. I think that makes it too easy for defenders of what's happening to say, well, this guy's not a whistleblower, and then sort of discredits the whole critique. But I would say the people who are providing information to the public for public education purposes without authorization of information that higher-ranking people of the government want kept secret. 9 promised prosecutions in this administration versus 3 in all of American history combined. Radical change, right? And when there is a—so I have a whole chapter looking at each of the 9 cases and trying to figure out behind the scenes, where did this come from? Because when you see something that turns on a dime like that, a sea change, you really want it to be to make sense. You want someone to have at least decided to do that.
We have 20 seconds.
Okay. And part of what I came up with was this just happened because technology, this goes back to Snowden, because of technology, it's impossible to hide who's in contact with whom anymore. And cases are viable to investigate now that weren't before. That's not something Obama did or Bush did. It's just the way it is in the 21st century. And investigative journalism is still grappling with the implications of that.
But did you expect Obama to do better, since he had attacked Bush so much on these issues?
Well, I don't want to say better or worse. That's not my role. I'm just trying to explain why did this happen, this amazingly surprising turn of events.
Part 2 at democracynow.org. Charlie Savage, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist at The New York Times. His new book, Power Wars, Inside Obama's Post-9/11 Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The time is 5:02. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Milagro Theater, presenting La Muerta Baila, Milagro's 20th annual Day of the Dead production, playing now through November 8th. Tickets at milagro.org.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the first CMJ College Day on Tour, Saturday, November 7th at Holocene in Portland. College Day aims to fill a day with great programming and speakers from and related to college and non-commercial radio, allowing both new and experienced voices from the radio world to talk about the issues that matter most to them. At this all-ages event, there will be live music, innovative workshops, presentations, and interviews with key members of the music and radio world from the Pacific Northwest and beyond. Again, that's College Day on Tour, Saturday, November 7th at Holocene, 1001 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Victory is mine. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Occupiers, a reading and book signing with Michael A. Gould-Wartofsky on Thursday, November 12th at the Q Center in Portland. The book traces the occupation of Zuccotti Park and some of its counterparts across the United States and around the world, from inception to eviction. Even if the movement fails to achieve radical reform, Gould-Wartofsky maintains its offshoots may well accelerate the pace of change in the United States in the years to come. Again, that's The Occupiers, a reading and book signing with Michael A. Gould-Wartofsky, Thursday, November 12th, at the Q Center, 4115 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council considers a sweeping measure to prevent fossil fuel infrastructure and developments in the city.
A key witness in Ecuador's lawsuit against Chevron has admitted to lying on behalf of the company.
And we'll get a live report from the City of Portland's Human Rights Commission hearing on divesting from companies involved in Israel's military occupation.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 4th, 2015. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The Portland Human Rights Commission voted 2 weeks ago to divest from four companies involved in the Israeli occupation of Palestine. The resolution was supported by a diverse coalition of local groups, including Jewish, Christian, and Muslim organizations. It asks the City of Portland to expand its Do Not Buy list to include companies that have contracts with the Israeli military to assist with its military occupation. The Do Not Buy list already includes Walmart and fossil fuel companies such as Chevron and ExxonMobil. The new proposal would expand the list to include the security firm G4S, Hewlett-Packard, Motorola Solutions, and Caterpillar. Today, a new hearing is taking place that includes local groups who are critical of the move. KBOO's Mohammed Nabil is there at the hearing and joins us live. Mohammed, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Hello, Mohammed. What is the scene at the Human Rights Commission today?
Well, till now, the hearing did not start yet, but, you know, like, everybody is, like, waiting to start the hearing. Everybody now talking about the fossil fuel, but we are still waiting because, like, there are so many things to be said.
So we were mentioning that today's hearing will include some groups who are critical of the move that the Portland Human Rights Commission is proposing. What are some of the arguments against this Do Not Buy list?
That, you know, like the do not including these things in the Do Not Buy list and using the divestment as a resolution to go for the freedom of Palestine is against the two-state solution, which is many of the groups who are still believe in that solution, believe that this solution is the best, which is actually is one of the dead solutions long time ago. And now is the only solution that for Palestine is to go and have a global pressure from outside on Israel in order to match the main three principles that the call for BDS call for, which are equal rights for everybody, end the Israeli occupation, and the right of return for the Palestinians. So this, this is like one of the arguments that the people who are against this resolution, they put on the table.
Has there been any other pressure on the commissioners to take back their unanimous vote for divestment that they made 2 weeks ago?
There was, like, some talks. I'm not really, like, one of the most people who are aware, but as far as I know, the mayor was, like, critical of the decision and some other people.
And what about other groups like Jewish Voices for Peace, which introduced the resolution? Are they at today's hearing?
Yes, they are. There is Jewish Voice for Peace. There is Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights, and there's Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, and also there's Friends of Sabil. Basically, most of the correlation who are contain occupation-free Portland is present on the hearing.
And will those groups be permitted to testify?
Some of them, yes, like mainly Jewish Voice for Peace and Over.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Mohammed. We look forward to hearing the wrap-up on how the hearing today went.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
That was KBOO's Mohammed Nabil joining us live from the Portland Human Rights Commission hearing going on right now in downtown Portland.
Portland City Council met this afternoon to consider three important resolutions. The first declares November as Native American Heritage Month in the city of Portland. The second concerns opposing any increase in oil trains in the city. The third resolution is to oppose the expansion of infrastructure whose primary purpose is transporting or storing fossil fuels in or through Portland or adjacent waterways. All three were introduced by Mayor Hales and Commissioner Fritz. The first resolution passed, declaring November to be Native American Heritage Month in the city of Portland. The second and third were being discussed at press time. Here are some examples of testimony relating to these second and third resolutions. We'll hear some amendments proposed by Commissioner Novick and remarks by community member Sherry Liu, a student at PCC and a native of the Philippines, who has witnessed firsthand some of the devastating results of climate change.
Adopt a policy opposing all project proposals that would increase the amount of crude oil being transported by rail through the City of Portland and the City of Vancouver, Washington. 1157, oppose expansion of infrastructure whose primary purpose is transporting or storing fossil fuels in or through Portland or adjacent waterways.
We are implicitly, by whenever we go to the gas station, endorsing the transport of oil. I think that it makes sense to say that we're opposed to unusually dangerous forms of oil transportation, but I think that we should implicitly and explicitly, in fact, acknowledge that we are not in a moral position right now to oppose all forms of transportation.
Honorable Mayor, City Commissioners, my name is Sherry Liu, and I'm a volunteer with 350 PDX and a student at PCC Cascade. I was born and raised in the Philippines, and I have been living in the U.S. in Portland for a year now. I am here to give voice to the people from the Philippines and to other developing countries around the world who are in severe distress and danger due to global warming and who do not have any say in the policies of the developed world that are causing our suffering. My own country is suffering increasingly from climate change. For us mainly, a severe worsening of typhoons resulting in thousands of deaths and enormous damage, especially in the past few years. Until 2010, we never had super typhoons in Mindanao, my island. But since then, there have been three super typhoons in our area, the Washi, Bupa, and Haiyan, with 10,000 deaths and billions of dollars in damages. I survived such a horror in Cagayan de Oro in 2011 when Washi hit in the middle of the night and killed more than 2,000 people in the district right next to mine. The fear, pain, and suffering is indescribable. We had never before had such disasters in our area, and there is no doubt that it is because of climate change. This is why I am here speaking to you today. Portland is in a key position to help lead the change to protect people here and everywhere from devastating and consequences of fossil fuels and lead the way for others to do the same. I want to thank you, Mayor Hales and Commissioner Fritz, for bringing this resolution to City Council. I call on the rest of the commissioners with all urgency. Vote yes to both of this resolution. Do what is just and necessary for Portland and the world. Thank you.
That was audio from today's City Council hearings that declared November as Native American Heritage Month and considered resolutions opposing the expansion of oil trains and fossil fuel infrastructure in the city of Portland.
A group of children suing the Washington State Department of Ecology to take action on climate change had a court hearing yesterday in a King County courthouse. This is the second time this year the petitioners have found themselves in a King County courtroom. In May, Judge Hollis Hill heard oral arguments in the case and, based on the undisputed climate science, ordered the Department of Ecology to reconsider its first denial of the youth's petition. But the department decided to deny the youth's petition a second time. Their attorney, Andrea Rogers, spoke with KBOO's Jenica Soderberg about the lawsuit to protect her client's rights to a healthy environment and a safe climate.
Actually, across the country, these lawsuits are taking place. Can you talk about the one that is happening this week in Washington State?
Last year, a group of seven young people, ages 10 to 15, filed a petition for rulemaking with the Washington State Department of Ecology, asking that the agency promulgate a rule regulating carbon dioxide emissions based on best available science. And a few months after we submitted that petition, it was denied, and we appealed, and are now our case is pending in King County Superior Court.
And what is the argument that you and the other attorneys in these cases are making? What kind of argument is there that that these children have standing to challenge state regulatory agencies?
Yeah. Well, you know, the one thing that our cases are in many ways very simple, because any citizen can appeal an agency's decision to reject a petition for rulemaking. So that's a very standard way to get yourself into court. Why our cases are unique is that we are arguing that these youth have a fundamental and inalienable right to a livable future that the agency is abrogating and violating by failing to take action to address climate change that's based on science.
And how is the Washington Department of Ecology using science that is obsolete in order to try to counter your arguments and your case?
Yeah, well, our case is interesting. Ecology has essentially ignored the science. We provided Ecology with the best climate science available. The lead expert in our case is Dr. Jim Hansen, probably the world's most foremost and prolific climate change expert. We also have testimony from Dr. Goldberg, who is an ocean acidification expert on coral reefs based in Australia, Dr. Richard Gammon, who's here in Washington, who wrote the first IPCC report, and others. And we provided all of this testimony and all of these scientific studies, and not once did Ecology ever respond to them, let alone analyze them. And what happened this summer is the first stage of the case is the court ruled that Ecology needed to reconsider their decision using the best available science contained in their own report and then a declaration that one of our experts had prepared. They came back to court after getting that order and are continuing to refuse to look at the science and are continuing to deny our petition. So this next go-round is we are asking the court to order them to promulgate a rule using the science, not just that they consider the science, but that they actually use the science.
When you say Ecology, you're talking about the Washington Department of Ecology in the state of Washington. Yesterday in
yes.
court, they, according to the transcript, said that they don't know if there is an inherent right to a healthy environment. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that is accurate. And, you know, they've never disputed that one exists in our case. But for the first time yesterday, they really questioned whether that even exists.
There are lawsuits like this one going on in all 50 states in which children have brought lawsuits against their state regulatory agencies, urging or calling on these agencies to actually take substantial action on climate change. Are there any states that have been successful in these lawsuits then resulting in policies at the state level?
I think it's I hate to say this, but it sort of depends on how you define the term successful. You know, no judge to date has declared that has directed a state to take action on climate change that's based on science. That hasn't been done yet. A judge has not rendered that ruling. However, the lawsuits have spurred a tremendous amount of change in terms of climate change policies. So, for example, in the city of Eugene, the city adopted a climate recovery ordinance that targets 350 ppm in the global concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by the end of the century. And that was a part of this litigation effort as well. And then also, you know, in our case, after we got that ruling from the judge in June, our kids met with the governor of the state of Washington, Governor Inslee, and asked him to direct Ecology to promulgate a rule regulating carbon dioxide emissions. And he did that, and they have started that rulemaking process. The only problem is it's not based on science. So there's been a tremendous amount of movement and recognition of the need, urgent need to act to address these kids' fundamental rights. But if you're looking for a court decision that has required it, that is yet to come, and we're hoping that Judge Hill will be the first.
And that is, of course, Judge Hill in King County, Washington. Again, we've been speaking with Andrea Rogers of the Western Environmental Law Center. She is the lawyer for seven teenagers who have brought a lawsuit against the state of Washington Department of Ecology, demanding that the state take substantial action to address the impacts of climate change. This is Jinka Soderbergh with KBOO News.
Chevron's efforts to escape a multi-billion dollar judgment in its legal battle with Ecuador hit a snag when their primary witness admitted he wasn't telling the truth about being bribed to ghostwrite a verdict in Ecuador's favor. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with Paul Pazimenos, Outreach and Strategy Director from Amazon Watch, about what impact the revelation may have on the decision by a New York judge who last year vacated Ecuador's $9.5 billion award.
Unfortunately, it's a complicated situation, and that's because Chevron has spent $2 billion to make it a complicated situation. But in essence, Chevron launched a show trial against the Ecuadorians after it lost in Ecuador, realizing they couldn't escape the evidence against them. Knowing they were going to lose in Ecuador, they brought a case in New York, the very place that they argued for years should not be the proper venue to hear the story about what they did in Ecuador, without reviewing the actual evidence in Ecuador. And without a jury, they sued the Ecuadorians and their lawyers, saying that they orchestrated a fraud when they got the verdict in Ecuador. The judge in the case, Kaplan, didn't read the judgment in Ecuador, doesn't speak Spanish, knows nothing about Ecuadorian law, and yet he made a determination that the Ecuadorians and their lawyers in the United States could not collect on that $9.5 billion judgment. In actuality, the decision legally offers Chevron nothing because the Ecuadorians and their lawyers were not seeking to enforce the $9.5 billion verdict in the United States. At least at that time. They're seeking to enforce that verdict in Canada, Argentina, Brazil, and possibly other places. And the Supreme Court of Canada has recently ruled unanimously that the Ecuadorians can proceed with a trial in Canada to seize Chevron's assets. So Chevron, not wanting to have to defend itself on the evidence, orchestrated a show trial in New York based almost entirely upon the testimony of what we now know, and Amazon Watch has been saying for some time, was a compromised, corrupt, and bribed witness. He's now admitted in another trial under oath that when he testified for Chevron in their show trial, he lied, embellished, and said things specifically to get a bigger paycheck from Chevron. Chevron bought him a house, a car, moved his entire family to the United States, paid his legal fees to get him status here, paid him $12,000 a month just to keep him living in the new style he was accustomed to, and all so that he could offer testimony in this RICO case. When Chevron made that deal with him, he had less than $200 in his bank account. So this was a man who was admittedly corrupt, destitute, and Chevron swooped in and said, we'll give you a home in the United States, a car, move your family, pay you a salary. All you need to do is come here and testify and say that you were offered a bribe in order to ghostwrite a judgment. And the problem with Guerra's testimony is there was never any real evidence to back it up in the first place. So if you remove that testimony, Chevron's entire case falls apart. This is their worst nightmare because the only defense that they have to offer in Canada or anywhere else was intended to be trumpeting this verdict in the United States, saying that the verdict in Ecuador was a fraud. But if the courts in Canada or anywhere else look into the decision in New York and what it was based upon, they're quickly going to see that the principal witness in Chevron's case has now admitted that he lied and made up the story.
So what part of this case was being heard in April?
An additional proceeding that Chevron itself has initiated, it has been trying to force the government of Ecuador to cover its liabilities for polluting the Amazon. Now, of course, the government of Ecuador is fighting back against this and is showing that the trial in Ecuador was actually the most litigated trial in the history of the country, and Chevron was given years to defend itself, and that the verdict against it was authentic. And in doing so, it has offered forensic evidence proving that the judgment in Ecuador was written, as it should have been, by Judge Nicolas Zambrano, the presiding judge in the case, and that there was no evidence of ghostwriting whatsoever. And during this cross-examination, they brought Alberto Guerra to the stand, who then admitted that what he said in Chevron's RICO trial was a lie. The one shred of his testimony that he still maintains is that he was offered a bribe, but no details as to how much or for what, and no evidence of it. Chevron is clinging to that last shred that they have from Alberto Guerra and saying to the world, he did not recant. He's simply a witness who, in the past, we acknowledge, has been less than truthful. It not only means they won't be able to use this in Canada and elsewhere to defend themselves, it also means that they're likely to be investigated for breaking the law in the United States, because it is illegal to pay for witness testimony. You can't pay someone to testify as to facts in a case, which is what Guerra did, and he was paid over $2 million at this point to testify. Just paying for testimony is illegal. Paying for testimony that you know is false is worse. And we believe Chevron is responsible for both of those things, and we want to see them investigated and prosecuted for that.
With the 21st session of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change getting underway in a few weeks in Paris, talk about the level of presence companies like Chevron enjoy in those settings.
They're already trying to influence what's going to happen at the COP. There's been recent massive news about what Exxon knew and has been hiding for years about the effects of fossil fuels and climate change. And there was recently a meeting to prepare for the COP21 in Bonn, the climate change conference, which took place, I believe, just last month. And all the fossil fuel industry is trying to assert its influence over setting, reducing the goals for reduction of emissions that governments commit to. That includes Chevron.
I've been talking with Paul Pazaminos from Amazon Watch. For more information, you can visit their website at amazonwatch.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Poor news.
Following TransCanada's recent request to, quote, pause, unquote, its request for review of the Keystone XL pipeline, the Obama administration has just said no. The request for suspending the review was characterized by TransCanada as relating to their efforts to secure an approved route through the state of Nebraska. The process in Nebraska has been delayed following a rejection of TransCanada's initial proposed route through the state. TransCanada made a request to the State Department to delay the review on Monday. Today, the State Department released a statement saying that, in respect for the process, the review would continue. Observers remark that TransCanada's move comes in the wake of a renewed environmental focus on the part of President Obama and is seen as a tactic to defer the decision to a new administration.
The rule of law has been suspended in the Maldives, an island nation in the South Pacific. The president has declared a 30-day state of emergency and granted the police sweeping authority to arrest anyone deemed to be a security threat. The crackdown comes ahead of major opposition rallies on Friday organized by the Democratic Party of the Maldives, the party of former Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed. Nasheed was the nation's first democratically elected president before he was ousted in 2012 and sentenced to 13 years in jail earlier this year on alleged terror charges. His supporters say the charges against him are ridiculous and an insulting attempt to stifle dissent in the island nation. In September, the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention ruled his imprisonment illegal under international law. Nasheed, known widely as a climate hero, had set the island nation on course to become the world's first carbon-neutral nation. However, the new administration has apparently scrapped these ambitions in favor of a plan that triples the country's emissions by 2030 and imports huge amounts of oil for power generation. In addition, the current leadership has announced plans to drill for oil underneath the Maldives' pristine coral reefs. The imposition of the state of emergency comes amid a deteriorating political situation, including the arrest of Vice President Ahmed Adib on Saturday.
You are listening to the KBOO News for Wednesday, November 4th, 2015. Our newscast will be followed by Poor News Network at 5:45. At 6 o'clock, it's Treasures from the Archives. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in Portland should be cloudy with occasional rain showers and a high of 53, moving to cloudy and 44 tomorrow night. Today in history, on November 3rd, 1922, in Egypt, British archaeologist Howard Carter and his team found the entrance to the tomb of Pharaoh Tutankhamun in the Valley of the Kings. Our quote of the day is from Robin Williams, who said, "You're only given a little spark of madness. You mustn't lose it."
It's 5:30, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Poor old Jeb seems to have a terminal case of Mitt Romney disease. He just keeps blurting out asinine comments that reveal the fact that he is, in heart, soul, and political mindset, yet another son of a Bush. His inner bigotry against the poor, coupled with his cartoonish concept of the black community's political motivation, was outed recently when he was asked how he planned to win the votes of African Americans. "Our message is one of hope and aspiration," he responded. "Okay, Jeb, go positive. So far, so good." But then, the deep prejudice derived from his narrow upbringing as a child of privilege surfaced. "My campaign message is not one of division and get in line and we'll take care of you with free stuff," he asserted with a sneer. Then, to punctuate his little lecture on how to appeal to low-income black families, the multimillionaire heir to the Bush fortune said he would tell them, "You can achieve earned success." Yes, Jeb, instead of hard-hit people who've been downsized or left jobless lining up to get what you call free stuff, like unemployment compensation and health care, better to challenge them to earn success. Tell them to have the gumption, as you did, to be born to rich parents, to be welcomed as legacy applicants into the most prestigious schools, and to have their fathers open the doors for them to achieve financial and political success. This is Jim Hightower saying, yet the former shoe-in for the GOP presidential nomination can't figure out why he's running third in New Hampshire and fifth in Iowa, even after he poured millions into a month-long blitz of TV ads to goose up his appeal. Such shallowness, callousness, and condescension exposes an ingrained contempt for all who don't live in Bush's elite zip code. No one but his fellow one percenters want a clueless guy like that in the White House.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A Walmart in Mississippi was bombed by an attacker associated with the so-called Southern Heritage terrorist organization. The suspect has been taken into custody after throwing a homemade explosive at a Walmart in Tupelo, Mississippi. His complaint against the chain was that they had stopped selling Confederate flags. Marshall Leonard is the man suspected in the case. He's been outspoken about Walmart's decision to stop carrying the flags, posting numerous threatening messages on Facebook. The explosive was small, and the damage to the storefront was minimal. No injuries were reported. The doctor who championed Oregon's right to die law passed away yesterday after taking a lethal dose of drugs. Dr. Peter Rasmussen was one of the first physicians to openly support Oregon's Death with Dignity Act in the 1990s. Facing pressure from then-U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft, Rasmussen remained steadfast in his support of the Oregon law, even when faced with potential prosecution for prescribing lethal drugs to patients. A Salem-based oncologist, Rasmussen founded the Willamette Valley Hospice. Rasmussen was also instrumental in the creation of Do Not Resuscitate orders, allowing people to determine the care they receive if they are in a life-threatening situation and incapacitated and unable to state their desires in that moment. Those orders now serve as the template nationwide as states begin to craft their own Do Not Resuscitate laws. KBOO's Jimmy Tardy spoke with former state representative George Amy about the legacy of Mr. Amy's friend, Dr. George Rasmussen.
I'm very saddened by the loss of what I consider one a dear friend and a very courageous individual. Dr. Rasmussen stepped forward in 2001 when then U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft attempted to sanction physicians in Oregon for participating in Oregon's Death with Dignity law. Dr. Rasmussen was one of the first physicians in the state to prescribe for his patients. And he did so out of compassion. And when the Attorney General made that ruling, he was willing to step forward and defend his patients and himself from sanctions of that nature. I was very fortunate to speak to Dr. Rasmussen this last Saturday, October the 31st. And he and I talked about his participation in the law and the good that he's done. And I thanked him very much for everything that he did and that I would miss him, but that he bravely was going to make another journey using Oregon's law, which he did on Tuesday. His legacy is obviously the patients that he provided services for, including all of his oncology treatment and saving patients. But in addition, as to the movement in Oregon's Death with Dignity, he will forever be remembered for participating, standing up right off the bat, and also the fact that he was criticized by not only people who oppose the law, but sometimes by his own peers. But he would quietly and courageously step forward and made sure that his patients received the best treatment and have this as an option. I think what he said to me at the end, I will forever hold dear to me, and that was, he said, whenever I've needed you, George, you have been there for me. And he thanked me, and I said, it is the same for me. And I was able to say my goodbyes to him. And I think a great man passed, but will not be forgotten.
That was KBOO's Jimmy Tardy speaking with former State Representative George Amy about the passing through physician-assisted suicide of his friend, Dr. George Rasmussen, founder of the Willamette Valley Hospice and champion of Oregon's Death with Dignity effort.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, November 4th, 2015. Israeli troops kill a Palestinian youth and kidnap 32 others in invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers shot and killed on Wednesday a young Palestinian man near Halhul town north of the southern West Bank city of Hebron, allegedly after he rammed two soldiers with his car, seriously wounding one. The army claims that the Palestinian driver, Ibrahim Skafi, 23 years of age, deliberately targeted the soldiers before they shot him dead. Eyewitnesses said that soldiers shot Skafi from Hebron city with at least four rounds, although he was already injured behind the driver's seat. Several Israeli ambulances rushed to the scene to provide medical aid to the wounded soldiers, while the army prevented a Red Crescent Palestinian ambulance from approaching the scene. Following the incident, soldiers closed the area and sealed the Gosh Etzion junction to all Palestinian traffic. Clashes took place between the soldiers and scores of local youth. In related news, several Palestinians suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation during clashes with Israeli soldiers near the Aid refugee camp north of Bethlehem. The soldiers also invaded Tekoa town east of Bethlehem and clashed with local youth. Elsewhere, Israeli forces on Wednesday afternoon physically assaulted a Palestinian cameraman and confiscated his filming equipment near Al-Jalama military checkpoint north of Jenin. Moreover, an elderly man and his grandson has been injured Wednesday after Israeli soldiers assaulted them at the main entrance of Beit Umar town north of the southernmost bank city of Hebron. On Tuesday night and Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers kidnapped 32 Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank, including occupied Jerusalem. Invasions and abductions were largely focused in the West Bank districts of Jerusalem, Hebron, Ramallah, Nablus, and Jenin. Many children were among the kidnapped Palestinians, the Palestinian Political Prisoner Society reported. In other news, an Israeli military court sentenced on Wednesday a young Palestinian woman, a second-year student of media department in Birzeit University, Jureen Esaed Oude, to 3 months under arbitrary administrative detention without charges. Oude, 19 years of age, was kidnapped after Israeli soldiers invaded her home in Shikba village near Ramallah on Wednesday, October 28th. The soldiers assaulted the young woman, causing several injuries, and moved her to the Hasharon military prison. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, November 4th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Ishmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
Today, a noted human rights activist has completed 15 years in what is likely the longest hunger strike in history. FSRN's Bismillah Gilani has more.
Hundreds of students, human rights activists, and civil society organizations join marches and solidarity fasts to mark the 15th anniversary of Irom Sharmila's continuous hunger strike against the controversial Armed Forces Special Powers Act, also known as AFSPA. Sharmila is being held against her will at a hospital, where authorities keep her alive by force-feeding her drugs and nutrients through a nasal tube. The protesters criticize the government for criminalizing Sharmila's peaceful struggle, rather than publicly addressing the reasons behind her protest. P. Sundaram from the Coalition for Nuclear Disarmament was among the activists taking part in a solidarity fast in New Delhi.
Here's a lady who is brave, who is relentless, who has been sitting on this strike for 15 years, and the state has not responded to her. Not even a single proper dialogue has happened to her. Now, on the contrary, you would see that the Indian state is always ready to have dialogues with underground groups, insurgent groups, armed groups. And if at all this means anything, it means that there's a huge challenge before our democracy. AFSPA is a very, very important, urgent issue which needs to be addressed. And it's very unfortunate that the government is not listening to people who are protesting peacefully.
43-year-old Irom Sharmila began her protest in the year 2000 after Indian Army killed 10 people in her hometown in the northeastern state of Manipur. She says she will end her fast only after the law that gives the Indian security forces sweeping powers and has led to widespread human rights abuses is repealed. Last year, a court in Manipur had ordered her release, ruling that her fast was a form of political protest and not necessarily a suicide attempt. It's a crime to attempt suicide in India, and the authorities had used the charge as a legal basis for her detention. But barely 2 days after her release, she was rearrested and again charged with the same offense. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jimmy Tardy and Robin Ryan. The producer is Galen Sanford. Special thanks to reporter Mohammed Nabil. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with Colleen Swenson, one of the chief petitioners for the Portland Community Equality Act, which would eliminate Portland's commission form of government. At 9 o'clock, Teresa Mitchell returns for Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Pierre Fagerin follows up on his show last week and talks some more about banks and debt and how much debt we really have. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, we speak with award-winning author Colin McCann about 13 Ways of Looking, his new short story collection. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, Portland's Lillian M. Whitlow returns with Lift Every Voice and Sing, an anthology of short biographies of outstanding African Americans. Thank you, KBOO members, for your financial support, keeping this station on the air. If you are not currently a member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned right now for a dispatch from the Poor News Network, and have a great evening.